Hear ye, the United States of Court of Appeals, 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Good morning.
Morning.
This morning we have only two appeals to hear. We're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs. We've read the authorities that you have cited in your briefs. We've looked at the record, and you have limited time this morning. So when it is your time to speak, you should feel free to go straight to the heart of your argument. You do not need to educate us about the background of your case. We understand it. We're probably going to have some questions. If the court has a question, please do stop and try to help us with the questions that we have. And be mindful of the clock. When the clock expires, when your time expires, it's time to wrap it up. But if you're answering a question from the court, feel free to finish your answer, even if that extends it a little bit further. But do be mindful of the clock. Our first case this morning is Archer versus America's First Federal Credit Union. Mr. Archer, we're going to hear from you first, but before we do, I wanted to give you a little bit of a perspective. I'm only speaking for myself this morning, but I wanted to tell you something that concerns me about the case and give you a little bit of a background of what concerns me.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we have an issue in this case, as you well know, the issue that the district court ruled on about the statute of limitations, whether it expired and whether there was equitable tolling of the statute of limitations. But there's also another ground on which we could affirm the district court potentially. And that is the ground about res judicata. Now, as I understand what occurred here, there was a separate litigation, a separate lawsuit between you and the credit union that occurred in the state courts. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court of Alabama. And the doctrine of res judicata means that when the same parties have a dispute about some facts or some transaction between them, that they really have to bring up all the issues about those facts and about those transactions in that lawsuit. And they can't split those between different courts and different actions, different lawsuits. It all has to be litigated in one lawsuit. And once a lawsuit like that is litigated fully through a court system, it could start in the federal court, or it could start in the state courts, or you could have two in the federal court system or two in the state court system. But once one of them has been fully resolved and a final judgment has been entered, then the doctrine of res judicata says it's over. That means everything, not only that was actually argued in the case, but everything that could have been argued in that case is now resolved. And you can't re-litigate, re-argue or get a do-over, so to speak, in the other case. And my concern about this, as I understand it, is that the litigation that went through the state court was an ejectment action.
Mm-hmm.
And the state court decided that the credit union had validly foreclosed on your home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were arguments that were made by your lawyer. You were represented by a lawyer in that litigation about the real estate, the federal law that is at issue in this case. Maybe mm-hmm. not the exact same arguments, but at least some arguments about that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that you could have made exactly the same arguments. That court system was open and available to you to make those arguments. And so the doctrine of res judicata, at least for me, would suggest you had your opportunity to raise whatever argument you were going to make about this ejectment action and foreclosure and the validity of it and whether the credit union complied with this federal law or not. So you can certainly, you should feel free to address any argument you want to this morning, but I wanted you to know at least where I was coming from in terms of that alternative, what we call an alternative argument, that other basis for the for potentially affirming the district court, even whether the district court addressed it or not. It was something that was raised and is still being raised here by the credit union. So now we'll begin your time.
Okay. Well, good morning, Your Honors, and it may it please the court. My name is Lewis Archer. This is my wife, Cherie Archer. And we are both appellants in this case, and I'm representing myself and my wife, Cherie. Right. First, right off the bat, I want to say that I know that this court does not chit-chat, but gets straight to the questions before the court. What I would like to say that I am overjoyed that the 11th Circuit Court, which is one notch below the Supreme Court of the land, would take the time to come to us wherever we are in the middle of this pandemic to hear about our dilemma concerning our home with this defendant. We really appreciate that. I had a with what you mentioned, Chief Judge Pryor, does compulsory counterclaim preserving the federal charges as compulsory counterclaim does not play a part in the state?
You know, as I was mentioning, you don't really get to ask us questions, but I'll be happy. I'll be happy to tell you that when I was explaining the doctrine of res judicata earlier, part of the point is whether it's even a compulsory counterclaim or not. If it's an argument that involves the same facts or transaction, the same basic dispute, if it's an argument or a claim, or a complaint, or a counterclaim, if a defense, any of those kinds of things that you could have raised in that case against the same party. And at the end of the day, a final judgment was entered and you lost. You don't get a second bite at the apple in another court system and in another lawsuit. That's what the doctrine is about.
Mm-hmm. So I'll read what I have, Your Honor. If I'm repeating myself, you can let me know. What I had here is a question. While considering whether to toll our statute of limitation period in this RESPA case, did the district court err in context when it did not compare our diligence to the diligence of reasonable people who were tortured as we were tortured by this defendant? Your Honor, I think that plays a big part in this case, in that when I went to the lawyer and I realized that, and I was specific instructions to file to go to federal court. That's why I did not want to go to state court. I knew federal court. And as I think back, I realized that torture is hard to get around, because it was after you've seen what we went through. When I sat with that lawyer, my wife was in a coma, and the lawyer was looking at me like I was nuts, because I remember telling him, he thought, well, this credit union had sure pushed him over the edge, because I was telling him that, you know, God is in this. In any case, so that plays a part, that torture part. So what is the behavior of people in that state of mind? I have here, torture is a small word with tremendous consequences. You know, that alters a person's behavior entirely. Torture changes any context tremendously. I've got here, in Salcedo versus Hannibal. You know, you saw that in the brief.
Mr. Archer, see, one of the problems I'm having is that I understand you had a lawyer, and your contention is that you told him you wanted to raise issues under RESPA in federal court, and you say your lawyer didn't do that. But it's pretty clear your lawyer did raise issues about RESPA in state court, and maybe you would have liked for him to have done that in federal court. Eventually, you have a federal lawsuit about it. But the fact is that comes back to what my problem is with res judicata. He could have raised every argument under RESPA that you're raising here. In fact, did raise some of those arguments, at least some of them, in state court. And so you really only get one bite at the apple to make those kinds of arguments. And they were made, or some of them could have been made there. And that case ended in a final judgment in favor of the credit union.
Yes, Your Honor, and I, as I look back, I recognize that the credit union was deliberately using up our statute of limitation. In other words, the credit union was at work here to accomplish a purpose. As I look back and see that was part of the plan to use up our statute of limitation. I remember.
The statute of limitations would not have prevented you from making every argument you wanted to make in state court.
Yes,
you were already there. You could make whatever argument you wanted.
Yes. As far as myself, I was told that it could have been made in state court. With me, just with my with what I was told, I was told that you got to go straight to federal court. You're not gonna get any. You're gonna be wasting your time in state court. So state court, I did not even entertain state court for half a second. I was told that that it's gonna be a total waste of time. So there's no way. So as far as me. And I realized that that's what the credit union had an upper hand took advantage of the fact that our state of mind and the credit union was definitely had a strategy there, Your Honor. It definitely had a strategy. And I remember simple questions being asked that took them months to answer. You know, and I should have represented myself. Well, I couldn't have. I was in the state of mind to represent myself, Your Honor. But
speaking of that, Mr. Archer, I want to make sure I understand one thing. In the appeal in the Alabama state court system, you did represent yourself, correct?
Right, when I ran out of money.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
That's when I took over. We're not on money. I took over, and then that's when as soon as I found out it was not in federal court, I reserved the federal charges, and I followed the rule. What I was told when I called, they said, "Look at the flow chart on the webpage." They said they gave me 14 days. They said to just file in the federal court. So I thought I was on track. I didn't even know there was an issue there. You know. I thought I was right on track, and that's why I filed those two federal charges. You know, and I found out that it was not what the status of things were. You know, so from my perspective, I was doing everything that I knew to do. You know, and again, can't leave out the torture. You know, under the circumstances, and as the court sees. It's a miracle that my wife is alive today, you know, because this was pretty bad what this credit union did, you know, and And they even turned our home into a torture chamber after they tortured us. They came banging on the door, ringing the doorbell, serving papers after my wife got out of the coma. You know, and so I did, once I took over, you know, which ran out of money, I got everything that I was supposed to. And I didn't even realize it was an issue at all with the federal, because I didn't want to think if it was me that I started, I didn't even want to think about state court, you know. But due to my state of mind, I guess the lawyers saw, well, this man doesn't even know that he's being sued. And in any case, so that's part of what happened there. But I wrote that reply brief in the state court, in the appeal in the state court, and I in there I put those charges, those federal charges.
Yeah. Judge Joffrey, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. Mr. Archer, you got almost a minute left. I don't know if you have anything else you wanted to
tell. Can I reserve that minute to add it to my four?
Yes, sure.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, we'll give you 5 minutes of rebuttal, and we'll hear from Mr. McCarthy. Mr. McCarthy, you on mute? Okay.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Terry McCarthy, and I represent the respondent, America's First Federal Credit Union. The district court's dismissal order should be affirmed for two reasons. First, statute of limitations and equitable tolling is not warranted. And second, even if the court finds that tolling is warranted, as Judge Pryor mentioned, we've raised res judicata and the failure to timely assert compulsory counterclaims in the state court action. I think since Judge Pryor mentioned it, I'll quickly address the res judicata issue first. All four elements of res judicata are present. We have a judgment on the merits, and that judgment was affirmed on appeal, you know, by courts of competent jurisdiction. We have the exact same parties in both cases, so the third element's met. And then for the fourth element, the same cause of action element, as Judge Pryor mentioned, res judicata includes everything, not just what was argued, but everything that could have been argued. And just a review of the record shows that every step of the way, starting with the answer and all the way through the appellate briefs, they were arguing in the state court action that the credit union violated federal law, including RESPA. And then some of their complaint in this case is literally, you know, pretty much a cut and paste of arguments that were made and facts that were raised in the state court. So under the doctrine that this court can affirm on any ground that has support in the record, we believe that res judicata is a reason to affirm. As for equitable tolling, I'll briefly address that. Essentially what they are saying is that, you know, they instructed their lawyer to file up RESPA claims in federal court. The lawyer confirmed that they were filed in federal court. But under the standard in the 11th Circuit is that, you know, an attorney negligence or a mistake, even gross negligence, that doesn't justify.
Yeah, the problem, and maybe one of the reasons, I can't say for sure, but one of the reasons maybe a judge of this court sent this case to oral argument was that that's a little bit more than negligence, isn't it? If you told your lawyer to do something and the lawyer said he had done it, but in fact had done something different, that would really be fraud, wouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, a couple of things. Number one is there's nothing in the record. They haven't put anything in the record from the lawyer, so we don't know if the lawyer, if it's a mistake, if it was a mistake.
Yeah, I know, but if we just take what they say for a moment and accept it as true, if which is what I think the district court did. The district court basically accepted that, but inferred that it was negligence, and it's not clear to me that's negligence. I mean, it rises if you accept that as true, which the district court apparently did, it would rise to a different level, wouldn't it? A more serious level, a more serious level of misconduct.
Well, and again, there's no evidence of what the intent or what the lawyer actually did. But I think Your Honor mentioning fraud, there's been a number of cases.
Well, it could be, it's a misrepresentation. Okay. It would be a different level of misconduct than just negligence, wouldn't it?
An intentional tort is what we're talking about.
Well, there's nothing in the record that the lawyer did anything with any intent, and there's that.
Well, as I understand it, the lawyer supposedly told the Archers that this is their allegation, is that that it had been filed in federal court when in fact it had not.
Yeah, and what the Archers
surely a lawyer would know whether that was true or not.
Well, what the Archers just say in their pleadings is that they were misinformed, that the attorney confirmed that it was in federal court. But what we don't know yet is if that was a misunderstanding, if that was anything in the record.
Of course, but we don't have anything to dispute that.
Right, and it's their burden to show that equitable tolling is warranted.
Right.
And so, and Your Honor, and normally, you know, under one thing that the 11th Circuit said in a fairly recent case, the case of Clemens v. Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections from 2020, one thing that it said is that, you know, controlling case law is clear that in attorney mistakes are generally attributable to the client under agency.
Sure.
Principles, and then under agency principles.
But affirmatively misleading your client would be different, wouldn't it?
Potentially, if there was evidence in the record of that, that he affirmatively misled them. We don't know if it was a miscommunication, or what. All we have is what has been put in the pleadings. And so, but at the end of the day, the district court, you know, succinctly said that these are not extraordinary circumstances, and there haven't been any cases or argument made to show that the district court got it wrong. And there's also the argument that was made. Mr. Archer argues that the state court case was in the Circuit Court of Mobile County. And then there's circuit courts in both the state system and the federal system, and that was potentially a reason he, as a non-lawyer, didn't know any better. But I know this court on a number of occasions has said, you know, even when an attorney is pro se, that doesn't justify equitable tolling, ignorance of the judicial process.
Of course, I mean, you pointed out about the absence of evidence. This was a motion to dismiss, right?
Yes, it was.
So this isn't a motion for summary judgment, and they affirmatively allege that their attorney had misled them, right?
They allege that for the
in which we accept as true for these purposes, right?
Well, you don't have to, Your Honor, because the first time they did that was in response to the magistrate's report and recommendation. Is the first time they argued equitable tolling. So even the district court could have not considered that argument at that time had the district court.
But the district court did consider.
The district court did. Yes, correct. In Your Honor, another prong of this.
Which do you think is the cleanest ground on which to affirm from your client's perspective?
From my perspective, res judicata. And in doing because I just think it's clear that all four elements are met. Because and then the questions that you're asking, the points that you're raising, you know, on equitable tolling, but I think it is it is clear that under the res judicata, this all four of those elements are met. And then in addition, a ground that I haven't even mentioned, but's in our brief, is we've argued that this was a compulsory counterclaim. And I know something Mr. Archer argues in his briefs is that he did raise the federal questions as compulsory counterclaims, but the issue is they did that in their reply brief in the Alabama appellate courts, which is too late to raise that issue. And Your Honor, I think our arguments are in the briefs, and I've said kind of everything that I feel like I need to say from my perspective. If the court has any questions, additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we just ask that you affirm the decision of the district court.
Judge Grant, Judge Choflat, do you have any questions?
Nothing for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Archer, you have 5 minutes that you save for rebuttal.
Your Honors, now defense with the res judicata, it must not be the magistrate judge is not comfortable that it is settled here. Now defense says that the fourth element.
Here's the problem with that, Mr. Archer. It's true that the magistrate judge in the district court did not base their decision on that ground, but the credit union raised that as another way that they were entitled to win. And the arguments were made there, and they've made them again. And you've responded to those arguments. So sometimes district courts rule on one ground, but the parties have argued, well, even if that's wrong, there's this other reason why the court could still be affirmed. And we have to consider that too.
I see, Your Honor. And the fact that I would bring up the fact that the credit union they removed all of what we submitted. They struck out all of our what we put in concerning this concerning the federal charges. I would point that out. Well, they had struck out. In other words, that what we are arguing here in this federal case that was brought up, that they took it out, they struck out.
Well, yeah. So I think there was a reference to that at the end of Mr. McCarthy's argument. What he explained was that you raised some of these issues once you were at the Supreme Court of Alabama, and they responded by saying you needed to have raised that by a compulsory counterclaim, and that you didn't, and therefore that's not something that was properly before the Supreme Court of Alabama. And the point is, I think, that when you were represented by a lawyer in the trial court, in the state courts, in the circuit court, the lawyer could have made that argument and didn't. And so it's kind of the same problem of, it's too late now to make that in another court system and in a second lawsuit. You get one bite at the apple, so to speak.
And that's what's so wild about this case, and extraordinary, Your Honor, because I can picture myself with this, a lawyer was thinking, here's a situation here. These people were just tortured, that this man's wife, one defendant might not live, and then this one is not in his right mind, might not be in his right mind, 30 days to be out of the house. And then here, the credit union, the last thing on their mind that they had imagined would be that they'll be in front of the 11th Circuit Court talking about this case. Not in their wildest dream, that they said, because they thought they would have got away with it. And since the defendant mentioned a compulsory counterclaim, I would point out, Your Honor, that I noticed in document 16 on page 287, also document 12, page 189, it's the same thing. I noticed that the defendant must not believe that what he said about compulsory counterclaims, because I noticed that the pages at the beginning of the document are super crystal clear, and then it just fuzzes up when it gets to the part about what I wrote down, and then it clears up again. You know, it's that. So that's all that I, as far as res judicata, you know, that's it seems that something is not comfortable with that, you know, with that res judicata in our defense, that is just something iffy about it, even though they bring it up. That's the job to sing judicata like a cantata, but it seems like there's something that's not quite solid with that res judicata, Your Honor, with all due respect.
Well, we'll look at it very carefully, Mr. Archer. I think we understand your arguments. You've made arguments in your briefs. So we'll look at the whole case, and we appreciate you appearing before us this morning and making your case. We appreciate that from both sides. And so your time has expired now, and we're going to move on to the next case. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.